We're on. The very first on-air Brands live show of the year. And as they say, of the decade? I don't know.
Yes, new decade, the roaring 20s.
I don't know why. I've never heard that before.
Wow.
Where's your flapper outfit?
Wow. Welcome into the show. You know, On Air Brands Live, each and every week we bring you into our world and welcome a fascinating guest into said world where we can have a brilliant and wonderful discussion. Today is no different, except there is one glaring difference in that seat. No Eric E. Cabral. He's on the road doing his thing.
Yes. Yeah. Building on our brands.
Yes. We're dividing and conquering. And so Lisa and I are holding down the fort, driving this ship, and we're happy to do so. The fascinating guest this week is a relatively new friend. He showed up to our last PodMax event. Just as unfortunately at that point in time, you were not a podcaster or a PodMaxer. You were just floating around.
An observer.
Yes.
an observer.
I did a fine job observing.
Yes, you did.
It's Andy Wong, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. Thank you. Welcome, Thank you. Andy. Welcome.
How are you?
I'm really good.
Yeah? It's 2020.
It is. So we met you in 2019. Like I said, you showed up to the PodMax event. What was it like for you? Was that some good stuff?
That feels like a lifetime ago, doesn't it?
Well, with the holidays in between, it really.
Yeah, that was cool for me to see because I was sharing with you earlier that as a podcaster, and it's been just a little over 2 years now with my Inspired Money podcast. And like most, I started doing all the interviews via Skype or virtually somehow. Some of them are over the phone, but rarely in person. But in the last, I would say, probably 6 months, I've been trying to do more and more in person and getting over that fear of, I don't know, there's like comfort of being like having that screen and space between you and your guest because you can refer to your notes and do whatever you need to do. But I found that doing it in person is so much better. So
yeah,
I've been doing that a lot more.
Do you connect better with with whoever
Definitely.
You're interviewing?
I think, face-to-face is just always better.
Definitely.
And when you're not face-to-face, of course, you talk over each other because you can't see one another. And that results in more editing.
Okay.
So do it in person. Get to meet somebody. Maybe you can have a coffee after or grab some lunch, which is nice. So, yeah, all reasons to get in front of somebody face-to-face, right? Because that's one of the big benefits of having a podcast. It's making those connections and meeting people. So it's so much better to do that in person over Skype rather than Skype. So PodMax for me was an introduction to being able to go to an event where podcasters and guests can get many interviews done in one sitting, which is awesome.
Yes, I'm so sorry for giggling. Our tech crew out in the other room, and I'm noticing the live. This arm is like squarely like hitting me in the eye. It looks like I'm just trying. It's like blocking my whole face. I have to figure this out.
This is doing live right in
we'll
person.
Figure it this out. Is what... this is the first time we got this stand. So
you should wear some safety glasses or something.
I know.
With my 5 foot nothing height over here, maybe. If I was higher, I don't know. Maybe that would just be
it's a work in progress, Josh.
Isn't life?
Absolutely.
Isn't life a work in progress?
Absolutely.
I like that you brought up the F word, fear. We were talking before air that I like how you attributed it to your time on the mic. We can all, most of my story revolves around fear and hiding and all that stuff. And finally working through that. But you are a guitar player also. For the record, for those tuning in, you're part of a family business called Runnymede Capital.
Yep.
Right. I know it was founded by your father in the early 90s.
Yes, 1993.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, we are fee-only financial advisors.
Great. And you are a guitar player.
I am.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's been an interesting adventure. I started playing guitar after high school. It was the summer after graduating from high school.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And those were in the days when MTV actually showed music videos.
Oh, yes.
You'll remember?
I think we're all in the same.
Yes. Yeah. I think we all
can. And I was like, I really want to learn how to play guitar. That seems so very cool.
Yeah.
And I think I mentioned that to my dad. And his advice to me, and this is like summer between high school and going off to college, so you have some time, yeah. right? You're really just trying to enjoy yourself, spending time with friends before you part ways. And he told me, he said, if you really want to learn how to play guitar, go take a lesson. Don't just sit there thinking about it.
There was no YouTube that you could go in.
There was not. He's like, go do it. He's like, there's nothing to think about. If you're saying that you want to do it, go take a lesson. So I think I took 4 lessons. I met some friends in my hall freshman year who also played music. And yeah, it was pretty crazy. We had like a punk hardcore ska band.
Cool.
Which, you know, I would put fake tattoos on. And people totally thought they were real. And then they were so disappointed. They never really figured out that my tattoos would change each performance. And I wasn't consistent about putting them in the same places.
You know
and
what it is?
That's great.
You know what it is, really? Because people, we just don't take enough time to really observe, right? Isn't there something to that? I think that we're just barely paying attention to our own lives.
Especially in college, everybody is insecure. And
right. Yeah. What comes to mind is Shawshank Redemption. If you remember the movie, part of his ability to break out of prison was on the fact that he got a hold of the warden's dress shoes and started wearing those because he knew at the end he was going to change into the suit, and to look believable, he needed those dress shoes in prison. And he's walking around prison with his prison outfit and dress shoes. And he says he got away with it and nobody noticed mm-hmm. because, as he put it, how often do you look at a man's shoes? And there's so much in that statement, and exactly with that, with those tattoos.
I think it was like 3 years in, somebody was like,
yeah. Wait a second.
Are those not real?
Yeah.
I love it. That's not real.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then I got old. I started playing acoustic guitar after college because you move into an apartment, right? My wife and I moved up to Boston. It's really hard to like plug in an electric guitar with an amplifier. Your neighbors don't really like you.
Yeah, they're not so happy about that.
Yeah, so I totally went the other side, other end of the spectrum. Acoustic guitar, Hawaiian music.
Mm. That so you never ukulele. Played Hawaiian music. You just kind of said, hey, this is part of what I want to venture into? Or
my wife was born and raised in Hawaii.
Okay.
She's from there, and I get back there to visit her mom and her sister. She has family. So through that, I really fell in love with the music, the culture, and started playing Hawaiian music. It's been a totally crazy adventure. People think that I'm from Hawaii, but I am not.
But you said you were scared out of your mind in the early days to get in front of people. So there was a time when you were playing behind closed doors, perfecting your craft, probably fantasizing that,
I never fantasized about playing outside of my living room.
Because you were scared.
No, I was perfectly happy just trying to learn the style of music, which is totally laid back island music.
Right.
It's a lot of open guitar tuning. Yeah. So it's like you strum. If you don't put your left fingers down, you just strum. It's an open chord. It sounds nice. The guitar could fall over. It's an open chord. It sounds nice. And then you're trying to finger pick, so you've got like a melody and bass going at the same time, so you can play by yourself and kind of get this big full sound. I just wanted to do that to relax in my living room, and I never wanted to play out. That was not my plan. There are very few Hawaiian playing musicians on the East Coast, so inevitably I ended up on these crazy adventures because people would somehow through the grapevine, they heard that I played. And they'd say, can you come play at our wedding? Or there's a corporate event. Wow. Can you come play? And I was like, now I need an amplifier and microphone and figure out how to do that. So
you also sang then, I guess.
No. It was just. And then slowly over time, what ended up happening is that I met a guy he had gone to NYU Law School. He was working in New York City as a lawyer. He was in employee law, employee, what do they call that?
Labor?
Yeah, he was in labor law.
Okay.
but he was from Hawaii. He's a great musician. He actually studied music in undergrad, and then he went to law school. And he was like, "Oh, I heard that you play. You want to get together?" And the first time I visited him in his apartment in New York City in Manhattan, and you know, I just thought that we were gonna have fun and jam a little bit. Apparently, he was like auditioning me because playing, and he's like, "Oh yeah, I think this will work." And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "Oh, I think that, you know, our styles work well together." And that's how it all started, because we had this duo and we would just go play at weddings and parties and all how kinds fun. Of crazy things. Yeah.
What an outlet for life, right? You could always do that and just escape and kind of enjoy that moment.
That pushed me, because my friend, as I said, he's a great musician. He studied it in school. He has the music theory, the performance down. And when you're playing with somebody else, it's a lot easier. It's less scary. But yes, absolutely, Josh. I was frightened out of my mind. Mm. Whenever I had to play in front of people, even with my buddy, Darren, my hands would be shaking and my heart would be racing. And on occasion, you do have to play by yourself. And that was like the worst. Like, that was my nightmare. I was doing something that I loved, playing the music, but like my body was in fight or flight mode.
Wow.
And fight was winning.
So you were, this is still college age?
This was probably about 30.
Oh, you're 30 years old now?
Yeah.
At that point in time. Were you at that point working in the family business?
Yes, I was.
You were?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so, because I thought you were, before you were working in the family business, though, you were, when you weren't, you were on a path doing what along with the music? Or did you think you're going to make the career out of that?
No. That was my dad's biggest fear. He's like, "Do not become a musician." And I'm like, "I don't want to be a musician. I can't even play in front of people. What are you talking about?" No, there was a period, I think after college, my wife and I, we moved up to Boston. I was working at Thompson Financial Services. I was working a graveyard shift at a semiconductor trading company. So I would go into work at 8 p.m. on Monday night and get out at 6 a.m.
Oh, wow.
So you do that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. You go in Thursday night at 8. You get out Friday at 6 a.m. And then you've got the weekend. You don't go back to work until Monday at 8 p.m. But that was madness.
That's hard.
Yeah, I mean, doctors, nurses, so many people do it. But I think it does really mess up your body. And I did that for 2 years, trading semiconductors. I was calling clients in Asia. I was calling Japan, Hong Kong, China, Singapore, all over the place. Mainland China. It was pretty crazy.
Was it always written, spoken or unspoken, that you would go into the family business?
No, that was not the plan.
It wasn't?
No, which is why after college, I went up to Boston and I was working at First Call. It's like a financial services company. So they're aggregating all the earnings data, earnings estimates that the analysts come up with. And then they're calculating like a consensus earnings number and publishing earnings releases when the companies are reporting earnings. And we had a database that we were maintaining and keeping up. And then from there, I went to the trading company. I was up at all hours of the night calling Asia, and they want to know why. They're like, "You're calling from the United States? Why are you awake?" I'm like, "So that I could talk to you. So that we could make a deal happen, buy some semiconductors and sell some."
So you were kind of in training, purposely or unpurposely, for the family business in a way. You were kind of getting your feet wet, getting a knowledge base.
I suppose. I mean, I really wasn't thinking about joining my dad.
Interesting. Okay.
I figured that, like, my first job was more, I got to stop hitting the cables. My first job was more operational. Like, we were doing computer, entering data. And this goes back to like 95, 96. So I remember my first computer that I had there had 1 gigabyte of memory. And my manager was like, "Oh my God, your computer has 1 gig. Like, you could never fill that up." And of course, now our cell phone, I don't know, what is that like?
128 gig. I have the speaking of, I have the Google Pixel. Any Google Pixel fans out there? It's a wonderful phone. What do you have? iPhone?
I have an iPhone.
Right. Yeah, I iPhone. Used to. I went in 2 years ago to replace my then iPhone.
Yeah.
On my way back to the wall, I saw the Google Pixel display. And I'm a big Google fan. I'll look into everything that they offer. And I was like, if they're offering a phone, I want to give this some real interest. And I walked out with the Google Pixel and never thought I'd be an Android person. Short little learning curve. You know, you get over it within the week and I'm never looking back. The point of that was to connect that this is 64 gigs of memory, right? Or space, I should say. And I wanted the 128, but I went in and they're like, oh, we're all out of that. So, I took the 64, but I haven't yet, opened it or activated it. So now I'm actually thinking, you know what? I should probably just return that. And because they could ship the 128. So.
Right.
You can get that upgrade.
Yeah, that's our geeky segment for all of you, sponsored by absolutely nobody.
We're not getting any money from.
Yeah.
No.
Google. But I love the Pixel. Right.
That was your commercial.
It's a good, right.
Unpaid.
And you need the 128.
Yeah.
I need the 128.
The trading company, I figured it's always good to have some sales experience. Because when I was at the financial company, there was like this barrier between those in operations and those in sales.
Right.
Like. They're like, oh, you can't go into sales. You've been doing operations. And of course, the salespeople get paid more. So I had this idea that, oh, I better learn some sales skills because pay is better. So that's why I went to the trading company. And that was in 98. So there was an Asian crisis, right? There was a fear that it was really caused by long-term capital, the hedge fund, having sort of imploded. But all the experts on Wall Street were saying that the Asian economies were going to take like a decade or more to recover because things had really gotten bad. And people in the U.S. who were Korean were sending money back to their relatives in Korea. And so my father had me on the phone. He really didn't like me working the graveyard shift, thinking that it's not good for you. And he said, you know what? I'm going to meetings on Wall Street and all the strategists and experts are saying that the recovery could take a decade or more. If that's the case, if you're selling or doing business in Asia, that's not a good place to be. It could take a really long time for things to get better. So he was telling me that maybe you should think about changing jobs. And at that time, right after 2 years of working the graveyard shift, I was like, yeah, I think it would be good. I'm not sure what to do. And then one of the ideas was, oh, why don't you come try working for me because I could use some help. And that's how it all started.
Was there an immediate, yeah, okay. Or was there like, I'm not too sure.
I think it took a little time.
Yeah.
And before I was all in, I was still living up in Boston and trying to do some work from up there. And then that didn't quite work. I mean, I was working out of my apartment and didn't really know what I was doing. So my wife and I moved back to Jersey so that I could actually work in the office and really learn.
Mm. And you have a brother, right? Is he also part of it? Because you guys have your other show that you do that we can certainly touch on.
Yeah, yeah.
But is he part of the family business as well?
My brother is part of the family business as well. So yeah, I mean, just to take you quickly through it, I mean, I joined my dad. That was 1998, end of 98. And that takes us into like the technology bubble and internet days where companies that had no business plans were like their stock was skyrocketing.
Yeah. Right.
And there were software companies that actually were profitable, but their stock was selling at like 50 cents. And they're looking at their competition and saying, those guys are losing like $5 per share. Why is their stock $300? So some of those companies were like, we have to do that too. We just need to lose money. And there was a company called MicroStrategy who did that. They had a profitable business. They saw what was going on. They started like buying other companies. They started losing money. And at one point, their stock was like, I think the CEO was one of the richest people in America, because the valuation had gone up to like $400. And he was like, this is absurd.
Yeah.
So meanwhile, my brother was working at College Retirement Equities Fund as an analyst. That's one of the biggest pension funds in America. They manage the retirement money of professors. It's all the academics.
Oh, wow.
So he was in New York, and he was having a ball because prior to him being there, they never really participated in IPOs. So they brought him. He's the young guy. They're like, you go to the analyst roadshows where they're talking about these IPOs coming onto the market and tell us which ones to participate in. So he was going to all these lunches. He was like, I ate more rubber chicken than I ever did in my whole life. And it was networking companies that were losing money. And he would say, yeah, this one's really popular. They would buy it, sell it. And meanwhile, my dad and I were approaching it with our like logical approach. You need to have earnings. We're looking for companies that don't have a lot of debt. And it was odd because those companies, those brick and mortar companies at the time, their stocks acted like they were going bankrupt.
Right. And
I mean,
and they were, they were solid companies.
They were solid companies. I mean, a lot of retail companies at that time,
yeah,
like Bed Bath and Beyond, their stock wasn't doing great, but their business was fine. Or Barnes and Noble, the booksellers, they were doing great at that time. I mean, Amazon, it was not what it is today.
Certainly.
It was all conceptual, right? I think it was 20 years later
when we actually saw
like what they were talking about in 2000 coming true, that the consumer is buying online and brick and mortar is having a hard time, but it took 20 years.
Wasn't there like pets.com and all of these like crazy, right?
Yeah. All of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was buy.com.
Buy.com.
Oh, that's right.
eToys. I mean, eToys was one of the early
ones. Yes. Yes.
And yeah, so crazy days. And my brother was having a ball because eating rubber chicken and telling his bosses which IPOs to participate in. And they would just flip them when they go public.
Wow.
They would just sell them for a profit. But their fund is so large that it didn't really make that much of a difference. It's like a little incremental improvement to their performance, but not massive.
So let's segue into the investment banking role that you play today. Is that the umbrella, your personal finance?
And it's financial advisor.
Yeah.
I like to say that the problem with the whole financial services industry is that the industry likes to create very complex products. I don't know if you've ever looked at an annuity prospectus, but it can be 300 pages.
Right. You read the whole thing.
No
right?
one reads that. And I know for a fact that even the people who sell them, a lot of the time they don't understand the product. And therefore, the consumer doesn't understand the product. I'm a financial advisor. I don't completely understand the products. I lean on my brother for that because he's read those 300-page prospectuses and written some reviews for our blog that, you know, trying to help people to explain what is it actually good for. Because I think that oftentimes it's being overpromised, you know, what the results or reasons for owning one are.
So what's the problem you solve in your business now? It's along that path, right?
It's along that path. We're there to provide objective advice for individuals who need some financial planning. They need help managing their money. People who are preparing for retirement, we're helping them with that transition. That's all about planning, right? I mean,
no.
I say it's like I had to drive down here and I had my Waze app to help me out to get me here on time. And with our money, most of the time we don't have a plan. We're not taught enough financial literacy in school.
So true.
So I feel like even with the advent of financial technology and AI and robo-advisors, like my industry is changing. But at the end of the day, relationship is important. And I feel like as the industry evolves, I don't know exactly where it's going to go, but we have clients who still need us. And we can still help them to do the planning and to do like prudent investing so that they can reach their goals.
Can you help me talk to my children about this stuff seriously. I have a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old, and I know that now it's time. It's never too early.
Yeah.
But I don't know really. Like, I know what I know, but like, do I know how to translate that to them and what's appropriate?
Well, parenthood is an ongoing experiment. Life is an experiment. Podcasting is an experiment.
Right. And this conversation, absolutely. Everything. This darn new mic holder is an experiment.
Just poking him in the eye.
Oh, it's crazy.
It's just an illusion. Don't worry.
Life is, it's all an illusion.
There's a lesson in there somewhere.
Are you going to start singing?
Did it seem like I was about to bust out the song? Yeah.
That's right. I heard that you're a theater guy.
From who, by the way? Where is that posted?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah. Some podcast interview I heard.
Oh, yeah. I am. I mean, if that, am I a theater guy? I come from the acting and film world. I spent many years some time ago in that space. But you know what I say? I inadvertently gravitated towards podcasting and live shows and videos and Pod Max, which is an event, therefore a production. That's all theater. That's all performance. That's all producing. I've created theater shows. I've created films. This is Pod Max. It's a podcast. It's just another version of.
It really is. Life is a theater, right?
Yeah. In some
Except
ways.
You don't know the ending.
Well, we know what the
it's a cliffhanger.
Is. We just hope to make the best of it before the ultimate ending.
Exactly.
Before
exactly.
the exit.
Yes.
Oh, my
exit
goodness.
Exit stage left.
You want to go there? Go there. Go. I'm with you, Andy. Let's go. What's the ending? How do we feel about the ending? Is there an ending?
On Inspired Money, I interviewed Tanya Katan, who said.
That's the episode I listened to recently.
Who said that, in her opinion, a theater degree is more valuable than a business degree today.
Okay, that's interesting. Having a college age or going into college, I'm curious. So tell us why.
That's her opinion. She feels like everybody is trying to go to the Ivy Leagues, and then they're getting an MBA.
Right.
And they all want to go to Stanford or Harvard Business School. And then they want to be an entrepreneur and start a business.
Mm-hmm. And she called it saturated at that point.
It's very saturated. It's highly competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, you know, you can't force your kids into doing anything.
No, you
right?
can't.
So her personal path is that she always loved theater. And her parents really allowed her to do that. And she just feels like, that has opened up so many doors because from studying theater in school, then she was working in the nonprofit world and coming up with all sorts of crazy, really interesting marketing campaigns because she was working at a museum.
Oh, yes.
And she came up with this idea for arm wrestling for art because it was like an art museum. And, you know, the supporters of the art museum, pretty conservative. And she's like, you know what? One thing about art is that it takes money to buy art. If you're going to own it and hang it, right? You can go to the museum and enjoy it, but those who hang it on their wall at home, you need money. She's like, that's not really fair. She needs to think of a way to bring more people into the museum to sort of level the playing field. So she came up with arm wrestling for art. Somebody, a well-known artist, donated a painting and she bought a wrestling table.
Okay.
Had it in the museum and people would come in arm wrestling for art. The winner got to win that painting that was donated.
Yeah.
And it just got so much, there was such a buzz about the story, right? The press picked it up, it went viral. It drove more people into the museum. The museum got more money and support. And so she found that it was her theater background, her creative thinking that allowed her to come up with some of those things. And today she is no longer at the museum, but she's a well-known speaker. She's spoken at Google. She speaks at all these tech companies, huge companies, mm-hmm. trying to inspire people to really think creatively. And, you know, you don't have to be boring sitting at your desk.
Right.
And her point also with a theater degree is more important and beneficial today than a business degree, also connected to when you do venture into the business world and have that interview, the theater background and experience is going to be a point of interest and benefit from the person in interviewing you to sort of separate you and say, oh, wow, tell me about this. How did all this come about? And what stories are here?
That's right. I understand that there's a show called How to Succeed in Business Without Trying. Like, that's what it's all about. If you're a great actor, hey, you can become the president of the United States. We've seen that.
And aren't we all, I mean, Home Alone 2, whatever. But aren't we all actors? I mean, we're talking about, you know, aren't we all performers?
Not all of us sitting at this table got the training. Exactly. So we don't know what we're
doing.
Right,
exactly, exactly.
You were at least taught some skills.
Some, right?
Screen Actors Guild. Somebody made it official. We're not official.
Wow.
Right?
I'm just using a lot of those skills and techniques into what, you know, this medium. It's all just different mediums. So the exit, life's exit. How do you think about or not think about life's ultimate end?
I try not to think about it that much, other than, you know, they always say that there are only two things that are guaranteed. That's death and taxes. So I just know that everyone's going to ultimately reach their demise, unless maybe the technology will eventually reach a point where they can download your
passing along to somebody else
into some like computer or something, or into somebody else. But yeah, I mean, everybody's life is short. It doesn't matter. Even if we live till 100.
Oh, I know.
That is really, really short in the grand scheme of things. So you got to make the best of what you've got.
I'm so glad you said that, because I have used that exact example on many occasions, that even best case scenario, I mean, I turned 45 this year, and I say that even best case scenario, I make it to 90. That's magnificent. Nobody's going to say, oh man, how did he die? 90, that's how he
died.
That's
a life.
Right. Yeah, and so that means my life is half over. Right. I got to say, so fine. Let me. And that's best case scenario.
Right.
So let me. So now that's the world I'm in now. I'm learning how to, you know, life is a dream. Life is an illusion. It doesn't matter. It all matters. Make the best of it. Do what you got to do. And I'm just slowly but surely every single day making that work for me.
Yeah. There's a lot in there.
Yeah.
Some conflicting information in there.
Or is there? But go ahead.
I like this. But go ahead. All right. I like this.
Some conflicting.
Go there, Andy.
He said that it's nothing and it's everything. It's like, depending on the day, you don't know.
Yeah.
We don't always know where we're going.
Yeah. Well, I also say in that conflict, which isn't life a conflict? I love that this episode. Isn't life theater? Aren't we all? Isn't it all an illusion? It'll end. Will it ever end? Does it end? Is there ever a start and a stop and end in the beginning? But I say that, do what you feel you have to and want to do, because on one hand, nobody cares. But then on the other hand, everybody cares. Meaning, you know, nobody cares. If I do something, as long as it's in line with my desires and path and goals, I don't have the need or the time, quite frankly, to make sure everybody understands why I'm making my decisions. So I'm not going to feel judged. We all have judgments. We all have biases, prejudices, things that irk us for personal reasons, right? If I see you doing something and I have a trigger about it, I better look this way, right? Not that way.
Very true.
So it's like nobody cares. Meaning, sure, you might feel that people are looking at you and scrutinizing you, but it goes back to the tattoos. Nobody is paying that close attention to you, okay? You know who remembers what you said yesterday? You.
Yep.
Period. Right. Thank you. Exactly. Only you. Nobody is like in their mind right now giving what you did or what you said or how you said it any sort of thought. So figure it out for yourself. And then on the everybody cares front, it really suggests that the right people care. When you do your good work, you will attract and bring in the right people who need to say, you know, thank you for saying that. It made sense. I finally get it, or it finally gave me the motivation. And I'm sure in your world, whether it's on the financial front or the podcast front, you must hear from people that say, God, that one thing you did or said changed me, and I made it work for me.
Yeah, I think we're all trying just to do our best and do the right things.
And nobody knows, by the way, what that looks
exactly.
Like.
Exactly.
Nobody freaking knows.
If we knew, I don't know. Then what?
That's part of the fun of it, though, right? It's like part of the challenge, part of the fun, trying to figure it out. And, yes. You know, when you say, okay, well, that might not have worked. Let's change direction. Let's change approach. And it's part of the, that's life.
That's
It'd
right.
It'd be pretty boring.
Well, now you're sounding like the person who says that if you hit the golf ball straight 300 yards every time, it's boring.
It needs to hook.
That's right. That's
so
why
go
I'm
back
going side
time.
To side.
Right, right,
and
right.
And going into the woods right. and going into the water right. because, you know, I don't want it to be boring.
Right.
Wow. I just let that silence sit and it sit. Where do your, do you have insecurities that creep in? You seem like a pretty well-adjusted guy. Has that
we
always
all have
been the case?
Insecurities that creep in. Yeah? I mean, it goes back to being frightened playing the guitar in front of people. It's all about insecurities. I think we all have it. And I was fortunate 2 days ago, I went into New York City, Times Square, to go to Reuters, Thomson Reuters.
Love that area,
for
by
a
the way.
TV thing. You know, I've done it several times. I still find it scary. And of course I have insecurities because I don't know what they're going to ask me. I'm sitting here and I don't know what you're going to ask me. Lots of insecurities.
Maybe it's the timbre of the voice that's suggesting the, you know, it had to be brought up.
That's the best, that's
the
best lesson.
Timbre of the voice. I like that.
Just make sure when you say something, you end on it going down, not going up like a question.
Have you read Split the Difference?
I have not yet. That's
oh, really?
Yeah.
That's one of his, I mean, the book is fantastic.
Is that Voss?
Yeah,
yes.
It is.
Yes.
Never Split the Difference, it's called.
I've heard really good things.
Yeah, I
about
listened.
Him and his book. But no, I have not read that.
Well, it's funny because that's, I mean, it's just full of, I mean, even if you're, I'm an audiobook guy, which I'm sure many of us are, that's how I consumed the book, and it's just fantastic. And that was one of his things in context to say, you know, because if you inflect the end up, you leave openness
right.
for e. But if it's a statement with no further question, it's down.
I'm still working on that, but yeah, it definitely makes a difference. And we're all insecure, why public speaking is probably one of the biggest fears, because we're all insecure.
Playing guitar in front of
similarly
people, right.
But I can say this because I learned it from the music. Is that you can improve, it gets better, and if you just keep doing it, that repetition matters. And I was listening to a show on the drive down here, and it was great because there was like a performance coach talking to this like concert bassist who has to audition all the time to try to get a job in a symphony. And at that level, everyone's so good,
yeah.
Right? And the guy who plays bass, he's that good. But he had like a 2-year fellowship as a young guy. So he's just in this group for 2 years. Meanwhile, he has to go audition everywhere trying to land a more temporary job. And it's that insecurity that you're talking about. He's going into it and then not succeeding. He's not making the grade. And part of that is because his nerves are right. It's like he's choking. He has the skill, he's put in the work, but when he actually goes for the audition, he's not playing as well as he can. And those who are judging, they sense that. They sense that he's holding back, or he's not wowing them enough. And one of the lessons was that you can't be focused on the result. You can't be focused on winning. You can only be focused on striving for excellence, because it's a minor difference, but it's a big difference. Because the winning is not in your control, but striving for excellence is. And there's a mind shift change there that's important, going in there and being able to not be worried about the perfection, which I think often holds us back because we're worried about screwing up. And most of the time, the perfection is not realistic. It's not really possible.
So let's break down that theory again. You don't strive for winning. You strive for excellence. Is that the same thing, different sides of the same coin? Because I know you said it was a mind shift thing. I'm getting that. But it's just how you look at what you're doing in the moment.
Well, whether you win or lose, it's not, you're not in control because there's so many variables. And in the case of the guy going for an audition, you know, he's being judged by like a panel. He doesn't know how they're feeling or what they had for breakfast, or they have biases and prejudices too. He can't analyze those things. All he can do is prepare the best that he can, go in there mentally and physically prepared. And interestingly, the advice that the performance coach gave him was that most musicians go in practicing like hours and hours up until going into that room. And he's like, that's all wrong. He's like, prize fighters do not fight the week before going into the fight. He's like, it's the same thing. You need to get good sleep, get 9 hours of sleep going into this thing, because you need to have a clear mind. You've already put in the hours of practice. One of the advice was watch some sitcoms. Watch some comedies on Netflix. Like, relax yourself because you did the work. And it's funny because I think that it is like this desire for perfection that can hold us back. And you need that to strive for excellence. But at the moment where you're going in to actually perform or do something, when you need to execute at that very moment, you do have to care less at that last second because you can't overthink it. You just have to do it.
Going back to an acting analogy, where you can't worry about the actual outcome, winning or losing, what I've learned early on is if I go for an audition and, you know, you're going to lose 99% of those, you're not going to get them. So that's a whole thing that, and gosh, myself included, so many of us go into the industry for the wrong reasons anyway, and we just desperately want the validation and you don't get it. And then you cry in the corner often.
The business is brutal.
It really is. And it's destructive, especially because you're going into it for the, like, I wanted that external validation to try to give my internal self the validation. It can't work. But on that front, you quickly learn that when you don't get a job, or you don't land that audition, you don't get cast, it's not always your talent, your skill, or your ability. It's outside of your control. Sometimes they already have the opposing character cast, and you just don't physically look the right chemistry together. It has nothing to do with you're a little short, you're a little tall, you're a little dark, you're a little light, you have blonde hair, we want dark hair. It's so many things are outside of your control that you may never even know about. So it's not about the winning and the losing, because like you said, the biases and the prejudices and things going on. And apply this to the person listening, apply this in your own business. There are so many things. You might network, you might reach out, you might pitch, you might want to find a partner. You might send an email. You might try to talk to a potential client and not win it, and then beat yourself up for 100 reasons when it has nothing to do with you.
Yeah, so that's one of the biggest things that I've been trying to do lately. It's just to go do it and get over that fear, because just like with the guitar, if you just keep putting yourself out there and you do it repeatedly, it was uncomfortable for like 10, 15 years, but it's much better now. I still get nervous, but I can survive.
So what was the change? What do you, I mean, we were talking about overcoming it, but what actually do you think is, you know, is it just
a repetition?
The repetition? Is it just literally like putting one foot in front of the other and just like forcing yourself beyond your comfort zone?
It's a combination. I think that putting yourself in that position repeatedly, that's part of it. Mm-hmm. Because the more you realize that you're not going to die, then you're willing to fight and not flight. And I have a teacher who used to say exactly those words. He's like, you know, die. You're not going to die.
You know, die.
That's what he said. He's from Hawaii. That's my really bad attempt at pidgin English. He's like, you know, die. Right. I'm like, all right, I'll try. And you just keep doing that. And you do realize that you're not going to die. And then from there, you're trying to improve. and make incremental improvements. But I did talk to a really successful actor, and he was saying similarly.
Well, thank
you. Oh, you're welcome. You're getting
actually,
the validation today that you needed.
Thank you. Wow. It's been a while.
He was saying you do all the prep, right, for an actor, and I'm not an actor, so I can't truly understand. I am not in those shoes. But he was saying that actors, you do all the prep, you're memorizing the lines, you're trying to understand the character, you're trying to get so deep into the character that you can understand the emotions of the character because you need to emote those emotions when the camera's on or when you're on stage. He's like, but as soon as, you know, they call action, he's like, you have to let all of that go. You're just in the moment. All the preparation that you did, you're not thinking anymore. You're just doing. And I think that that's similar with the audition of the bassist. Same thing. He was going through all these exercises. The performance coach is trying to get him to do jumping jacks. This is at home before any audition. Get his heart rate up and then pick up his instrument and just start playing. And get comfortable with the adrenaline so that he doesn't associate it as a negative thing. That it's not holding him back, that he's actually embracing it and saying, oh, when the adrenaline is going, you actually get better. And I have another teacher who said the same thing. He's like, that's the difference between the seasoned professionals. The amateurs, you get nervous and you play worse. Mm. He's like, the greats, they get on stage, they actually play better on stage than they do when they're at home. And part of that's experience, but part of that is understanding how to channel that nervous energy into a positive way to execute better.
I like that. And I think it's also very applicable to like athletics, you know, professional
same
athletes,
thing.
Right? I mean, you take, you know, 100 free throws, you know, practice every day,
yep.
But then you have an arena of 70,000 people all looking at you to, you know, tie a game, win a game. You know, you can't let that creep in, the fear and all that. You have to go, okay, I'm back in the gym by myself and let me go through that same exercise.
Yes, that field goal kicker.
Right. This happened this weekend.
Who, it's all
right?
On you. And
it's
pretty
all
much
on you.
Just you.
Literally,
there's
right?
There's a whole stadium and they're
right.
All your teammates. But it comes down to you. Are you going to make that kick? Or can you kick the ball through the uprights?
Right.
Or you're a soccer player and you're the goalie and there's a penalty kick. Like, that's it. And, you know, you either buckle under the pressure or you step up.
Right.
And I think preparing ourselves to actually step up and understand how do you do things better. That's what separates the greats from the average.
Yeah.
How you do things better, tying it to something you said about stepping out of your comfort zone, that I'm currently reading something about that and really learning and experiencing. That's really all it is. We are apparently hardwired to remain comfortable and to always come back to our comfort level of things, but that doesn't get us where we need to be because, like you're talking about, the adrenaline, when that kicks in or when you feel just massive uncomfortability or call it what you want, fear in some regard, but how you channel that and use it is everything. And to work right through that because that's where the growth happens.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And if I can add to that, over the weekend, I watched this movie called The Biggest Little Farm. Have you seen that yet?
No.
No, okay.
Oh, this story is incredible. There's this husband and wife in California.
This is true.
This is a documentary.
Documentary, okay.
That covers 8 years. The guy was a cameraman and in his previous job, but he and his wife decided that they want to go into farming in California. So somewhere, and I don't know California that well, so I can't explain exactly where it is, but it's about an hour from LA. They got investors, friends, and family to help fund this project. So they bought this farm. And at the beginning of the movie, they showed that the soil was so dry. It was like a rock. They're trying to they take a shovel and they're trying to shovel this dirt and it's rock solid. They're like, this soil has no life in it. And they found this guy who's a consultant who came and said, well, the first thing you need to do is you need to build this, it's like a compost barn with worms and soil, because he's like, the soil is what's going to give this place life. So there was that. And then there was this dried out irrigation sort of pond, and they had to fill that and get that going. 8 years later, the thing is, the place is like unrecognizable. They have animals, they have like 80 different types of crop. And the takeaway is that it's all about diversity. Today, the modern farming is so specialized. You're only making, like, you're only producing eggs, or you're only producing dairy. And like, the whole idea is that the diversity of having all the animals, all the plants, the fruits, it all works together. It's an incredible story, because the cameraman does such amazing cinematography. But then, since he's filming it all himself, it's 8 years of footage. Like, I can't even wrap my head around how many hours of tape there was that he had to edit down. But it just tells this beautiful story of their struggles, because every time they had a good crop, like if they had a lot of fruit, if they had bountiful fruit, then insects came, or birds would come eat the fruit. And the consultant was telling them, no, the longer you do it, I think he was saying, like, at the 3 year mark, things are going to start working better together. At like 5 years, even more so. And today, I think that's where they are. They find that every animal has a role. And just one example is that the consultant wanted them to grow ground cover, because that was going to be part of this whole biodiversity. And once they grew ground cover, snails came. And like, the snails were eating everything, like tens of thousands of snails.
Wow.
And he couldn't figure out, how do I get rid of these snails? And then he would just sort of stare at the stuff, and he's like, he's a problem solver, right? He's a farmer. He's got to figure out how to solve this puzzle. So he takes all the ducks that are in the pond, puts them in his truck, brings them over to the fruit tree area where the ground cover is. The ducks eat, like, they reduce the snail population by 80%. Like, everything has a role.
Use what you have, right? It's, yeah.
And it's the diversity that it all works well together, in contrast to the highly specialized and very technologically advanced farms that we have today. That's why it's called Biggest Little Farm, because it's going back to this traditional way of farming. And I brought it up because I have no idea what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing as a financial advisor. I told you about the complex products and how we try to help people. But I'm also a podcaster. I try doing some videos. Lisa mentioned that my brother and I have this project where we do interviews of small business owners in New Jersey. So what I'm trying to say, if I wrap it all together, is that it's the diversity. Like, I don't know which one is going to pay off best, whether it's video or audio or writing a blog.
Right.
Or going onto Reuters, or coming in here as
being
a guest.
On TV.
But you just try to do a little bit of everything and figure it out.
It's all an experiment. It's all a rehearsal. It's all life. It's all meant to be as it is.
It's a real life dress rehearsal.
Literally, right?
Are there do-overs?
Yes. But I like
sometimes
there's so many analogies in that farm story. In the movie, I'm sure, just, you know, there's diversity of opportunities that you have or that you've created. And sometimes one feeds another, or one, you know, one assists another in helping it grow. You know, I'm sure doing podcasting maybe has, you know, melded into your financial business.
Makes you speak better, right?
And be confident, probably confident, you know, in your approach.
It's you speak deeper.
It's all an
your
experiment.
Tonality. Yeah. So yeah, it's. I think that's fascinating.
But we're still there's still only one James Earl Jones.
Oh man. Where do you want to leave this conversation for people?
Where do I want to leave them? Well, first go watch that movie, because that movie was incredible. Other than that, yeah. How about a Buddha quote, if I can come up with it? And I don't know that I can. I'm not going to do that, because I don't know that I'm going to butcher it. Plus, I'm Christian. I'm not a Buddhist. How about if I do this? I am putting together a Hawaiian music concert that happens this Saturday. And it's a fundraiser. It's a lot of fun. And I think that's part of the diversity. It's like I have my work as a financial advisor. I've got all these projects, whether it's video or audio. And then you also have to do what matters to you. And it goes back to your values. Do something meaningful.
Jacob, 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 our tech
rock
over
star.
There. Look what he's doing in real time. That's some real time. It's not lost
it's
on
like
you, right?
It's like an award show.
Yeah.
Well,
this isn't our theme music.
No.
He went Hawaiian, obviously.
Oh,
that's
yes.
the point.
This is not the normal ending.
No.
I thought that I was getting the hook. I was like, now I got to talk really fast. Thank you. I thank my mom, my dad.
I know. Your agent, your accountant, your lawyer. No, but seriously, he went, you see, he made it applicable. Hawaiian music.
The Hawaiian music. Yeah. Comes full circle.
He's been dying to put this music in there.
Searching for the Hawaiian
searching
music.
Searching it to act as a close.
One day, Jacob, we're going to get you a mic, right? So you can actually Baba Booey this. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure there's a famous Hawaiian saying, perhaps, that you can leave us out. Like, well, I know. I don't really know.
Are we going out on this music, or is this going to segue to the, I don't know. We didn't practice this part.
Well, right. Who?
I didn't hear any of it.
Right. So who let everyone know how they can find you, where they can find you. Maybe tell them your podcast, your small business podcast, because I think it's a great window into small businesses in your area.
Well, thank you very much for that. Thank you for having me. Almost every Hawaiian song ends the same verse. Ha'ina ia mai ana kapuanala. That means so the story is told, because that's the refrain. It doesn't matter what the verse 1, verse 2, verse 3 is. The final verse is so the story is told, and it wraps it up. So thank you. People can find me at inspiredmoney.fm. I talk to all kinds of guests, really diverse guests, and try to tie money into it. Really, and if you want to hear positive stories about money, and whether it's an entrepreneur building something or somebody who's involved with a charity and giving money away, and it's something, you know, dear to their heart, I just find that these interesting stories hopefully will inspire the listener and me to do something bigger with our money.
I gotta say, this episode, especially when you put the period on like you just did, really gave me the chills, because it's almost like the sum is greater than the parts. Looking at our topics and where we went all throughout, it's so much stronger when you just now look at this entire episode as a whole. Fascinating, I said, from minute one, and it did not disappoint. It went deep. I mean, there's a lot here if you really allow there to be and really open your mind to what we spoke about and what life is and should be for you. Lisa, how do we go out?
So you can reach me at lisaholbert.com, and I'm wishing everyone a happy new year. I think it's going to be a good one, and we'll let Josh, you take it away.
Online, I'm at joshcarey.com. Thank you for letting us drive this ship. Andy, for joining us. Episode 1 of the new year. It's been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Josh McCown, CEO of Viva May Hospitality and the beautiful Renault Resort Winery. I have to tell you, the secret's out, and the secret is On Air Brands. On Air Brands, creative agency, which specializes in launching podcasts, transforming live events into live streaming events, and social media marketing soup to nuts. On Air Brands has changed the game. There'll never be a day from here forward when you and I and our companies don't need to be on the air. Every brand needs to be on the air, but so few know that. So it's great to work with a group that are ahead of the curve and to find a company that has been built on the core foundation of the future of marketing. If you're ready to broadcast your brand like they've done for my brands, take the next step and make a change that can transform your business. Reach out to On Air Brands today. That's onairbrands.com. Yes, onairbrands.com.